Welcome to Symphonies and Snacks, a podcast where we discuss contemporary classical music and food. We're back. There's two of us. Yay!
Yay!
We have a second presenter for this reboot, relaunch, don't know what we're calling it. You may remember him from the Eurovision special. It's John Ofer. Yay!
Yay! Hi, everyone. It's me. I'm back. Due to unpopular demand.
With enthusiasm. that was the opening from Wozzeck by Alban Berg, which is the piece that we're discussing today. The way the new format's going to work is we're going to alternate, Donna and I, choosing pieces. And this is Jonna's choice. Do you want to explain more about Wozzeck?
Yeah, so Wozzeck is the first of Alban Berg's two operas he wrote in his life. It's based on the unfinished play called Wojciech, which was written by the Polish German playwright Georg Büchner. Berg went to see a performance of this and he loved it and wrote this opera on it. So it's quite dark in places. It deals with a man called Wozzeck.
But I thought it was a comedy.
You did think it was a comedy. We went to see this one live, I should explain, at the South Beck Centre. You were giggling a lot of the time. But it was quite dark.
What year was this written before we get into the obvious comedy?
He started it in 1914 and kept working on till about 1922. He was in the Austrian army at the time, so obviously World War One is in there, and a lot of his experiences as an officer in the army went into writing this opera.
It's just a pain in the ass for getting stuff done as well, isn't it, being in the army?
Yeah. There's journal entries where he writes about, I haven't done any work on Wozzeck for a while now, so just like normal composers, really, always thinking we haven't done enough.
Let's talk about the plot of Wozzeck. First of all, it's about Wozzeck, and I was calling it Wazzeck for a while.
Yeah.
So I'm disappointed that it's not called Wazzeck.
So the plot, I struggle with the plot. We didn't see an acted performance.
Acted at some points.
Badly.
Not over the top.
Ooh.
Yes, so we saw an orchestral production. The guy playing Wozzeck was reading from the score because he was the understudy.
It was very good.
He was called up last minute.
Yeah. It was like an injury situation. And it was like, oh, you're on.
Yeah.
And he had to just lace up his boots and go, can you tell me what the plot was? Because I didn't get it.
So you have this man called Wozzeck. He's a sort of rural Polish peasant of some description. He's got a couple of jobs to make ends meet. He does odd jobs for the captain of the local militia. He also allows the local doctor to conduct medical research upon him. And he goes out and does a bit of hunting and poaching as well to get by. He's got a woman. They're not married. They have a child. This causes various issues for him socially.
Does he own her?
Well, you know.
He's got one.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's called Marie.
She's all red, which...
She did.
Means she's
of questionable moral character, I believe.
Yeah, her virtues were not the most outstanding ones you could have talked about.
Are we slut-shaming?
She gets a little bit slut-shamed as part of the opera, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, so she is with Wozzeck. They have a child who's not really a major plot point in the opera.
They didn't even cast one.
They didn't cast one for this, although in the front of my copy of the score, the child is cast. but I think they don't have any singing or talking. They're just on stage to be referred to.
I think they're just pulled around.
Yeah, more or less. But as well as Wozzeck, she, because he's out doing these odd jobs all the time, is seeing the local drum major on the side. And this was one point you found very comedy, I believe.
Because he wanted to raise drum... No, not raise. He wanted to breed drum majors.
Lots of little drum majors with Marie.
We can breed them.
We will breed many drum majors. And Wozzeck is more or less aware that this is going on. But he has a sort of quiet acceptance of his lot in life. So, it's a little bit complicated. There's a party with all the main characters there, including Wozzeck. He has a bit of an argument with the drum major. And then...
this when the drum major sings his great bit. In the subtitles it came up, I have a woman, we're going to breed drum majors. She has... what did he say?
She has a firm bosom. And
she has a bosom,
thighs.
She has thighs, and they're both firm.
That's the one, yeah. That was how it was translated in the surtitles for us. That was fairly accurate. The surtitles we had were very word for word with the German, as far as I could tell.
And he started yelling, Schnaps!
Well, you know, it's a sort of Austro-German-Polish party. What else would you drink but Schnaps? they have a bit of a fight at the party, and then the scene shifts to the local pond out on the edge of town. Wozzeck's there, he argues with Maria, it ends up with him stabbing her, and then he has
You've missed the good bit.
He's muttering to himself, and he goes, "Ah, you feel cold, but soon you'll be cold, and cold people don't feel cold."
And she goes, what are you saying? And he goes, nothing.
Yeah, he stage mutters to himself. So she hears him muttering, but she doesn't hear what
That's
he says.
Why it's a comedy.
It's still quite dark, because immediately following that, he stabs her.
And then goes, dead.
He sings that she is dead, but just by singing the word, tot, in German.
Dead.
Yeah, dead. So, following this, he has a bit of a Lady Macbeth moment. He's got the blood on his hands. He wants to dispose of the knife. He throws it into the pond, but then he worries that it'll be found, so he's trying to get it back out of the pond.
I've just realised this is major plot spoilers.
Okay.
Does that apply to opera, or is it just films?
I mean, the text is Wojciech. It's very well known amongst the sort of literary thespian types. So I don't think it's you know, it's like giving away the ending to Romeo and Juliet. People know about this.
People get angry still.
It's true. Okay, spoilers. Don't you skip ahead about a minute and 30 seconds if you don't want to know how the opera ends.
Okay.
I'll
skip.
For those who are still with us, he has this moment where he's thrown the knife into the pond and then he's worried someone's going to find it. And so he's trying to get it back out again when the doctor and the captain, who just happened to be walking together on the edge of town, hear him, and he is startled, and they hear him, and they think there's something going on. They start to chase him. There's a chase scene with a fantastic honky-tonk piano part that enters really unexpectedly, which got Lucy going again on thinking this was a comedy.
He had a honky-tonk piano.
Yeah. And it ends with Wozzeck falling in the pond and drowning, followed by a little epilogue scene where the local women sing to Wozzeck's child that his mother and father are both dead. The end. So that's Wozzeck.
It was a dark comedy.
It's a dark tragedy.
I think there was humour lacking in the whole audience when we saw it.
Yeah, it has humorous moments, and you know, some of it is so dark you just have to laugh.
Yeah. And some of it has honky-tonk piano.
Yeah, not to mention a band that's hidden off the edge of the stage containing an accordion and a guitar, which various members of the orchestra have to leave at one point and sort of sneak into and then sneak back onto stage again.
And then two of the violins got stuck
Yeah.
and couldn't get back onto
They clearly
stage.
hadn't rehearsed their movements in the South Bank Centre. It was a tour and they were only there for one night, so I assume they sort of arrived, set up, and didn't actually practice getting on and off the stage for that bit.
Right. All I know really about Berg is that he does serialist music. So for people who don't know what that is, that's using all the notes kind of in an order. So you put them in a tone row and then you use that row. A tone row is the order that the note's been put in. Has this opera been written using serialist techniques?
It certainly had certain serial elements to it. So serialism was developed initially by Berg's tutor teacher Arnold Schoenberg, and Berg had been studying with him for a while and had actually finished studying with him well before he started composing Wozzeck. But he, as well as the serial elements, blended in sort of recognizable thematic things like Austrian army bugle calls and folk music and stuff like that to add a little bit of cultural flavor. He had obviously, being in the army, he knew quite a lot about the bugle calls used by the Austrian army. And this is something you find actually in a lot of Berg's work, that he took serialism but mixed in elements of late romanticism and expressionism as well.
So you talked about these kind of blended elements that Berg used within the score. What I found very interesting was the kind of things that I would now consider to be a cliche being used. So kind of a key example of this would be Mickey Mousing. So that's when the score follows a person's like footsteps or actions, and it was used a lot in early cartoons.
Yeah, hence Mickey Mousing as the name.
Hence Mickey Mousing. The example I've got is from King Kong.
Okay, which version?
The old one. So every time King Kong reaches for the person, so there's a little man hidden in the undergrowth. Every time the gorilla reaches for them, you get that little orchestral element, and then you get the bits where he sneaks away, and you get the dum 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 dum.
Yeah. Which is, where you actually match the notes to the footsteps. It's quite an obvious use of the technique.
I was just really enjoying me doing it.
So there was a lot of that in Berg's score, or was I fabricating that in my
It's a
This is
bit
a comedy?
hard to tell given that we were seeing a concert performance, so there wasn't a lot of moving. The actors were doing a bit of acting, but sort of standing still, so it was arms and faces. But you could feel like there was that sort of, certainly the music was very reflective of the action that was going on in our minds. That felt deep.
The action in our minds.
Yeah, and the music would
Yes,
match the action in our minds, man.
there were things like that, and then there were also elements of the orchestration that I feel really must have influenced Copland and Bernstein later on,
Yeah.
because it was quite a clean orchestration
The
in
thing
places.
I think like
all the instruments were acting quite separately. And it was a huge orchestra.
Oh, massive.
Like, I think there were 6 double basses.
Yeah. The thing to realise about this piece is how early in the 20th century it was written for what it is. It's very forward-looking. And, you know, things that we are picking up now as influences, clichés and so forth, they're still very new when Berg is writing this. You know, he started this in 1914. You know, we're only just past Debussy and Ravel, and, you know, they're still going, even.
Yeah. I just want to play an example of the orchestration, just to get the kind of flavour that I mean.
Yeah, sure.
What do you think? The orchestral postlude?
Yeah, that's probably a good bit.
Let's try a bit.
What I really like about that mode of orchestration is, so you can orchestrate in a number of different ways, and normally you would have everyone kind of working as a block in their section, but everyone's really separate, and you've got all these different lines entering over the top of each other, and they've still got like their individual voices.
In the strings, there's a lot of one part to a bench, even.
Which is so rare.
Yeah. It's quite a 20th century idea. You begin to see it more and more as the 20th century progresses. But yeah, at this time, very, very new and exciting.
And definitely went on to influence some American
composers. So I would consider that quite an American way of orchestrating.
I think I need to play an example to show what I mean. So as the example, I have Appalachian Spring, Appala. How do you pronounce that?
Appalachian.
Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copland, who, you know, great American composer.
You see what I mean? It's still got that very clean sound
that Berg was using, but obviously quite a lot later.
Yeah.
That was my only point.
Yeah. No, I very much understand where you're coming from. It's not something I'd picked up on myself in the listening. But yeah, it's a very... It's sort of dense because there's so much going on, but everything is so clear and crisp at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a good place to stop and talk about some food. So you said that Berg wrote this during World War One.
Yep.
Oh, I can't say D's. When he was part of the Austrian army. And one of the things he used to do, I did a little search for Berg and food, and found an article from NPR.
Of course.
About what he used to do. So when everybody else was eating army rations, Berg used to sneak out.
Well,
to find better food.
He was slightly more privileged than some of the regular soldiery.
But
yes, he was a little bit naughty at times with his sneaking away, I believe.
So I've got a great quote, which is from a book called Classical Cooks by Ira Brous. I can't pronounce anything today. And it says, "I was on duty till 8:30, then went to heat sing, and at about 9:30, in a proud and venturesome mood, I entered the restaurant Klein. First a portion of fried paprika with egg, then mixed vegetables. They had done the paprika. They had done the paprika like mushrooms with egg. Delicious. I had a feeling there was something else in it too. I bet he was a pain in the ass."
He comes across as a quoss. I've gone all Jonathan Wass on you. He comes across as a little bit pompous. He was at the time sort of participating in the sort of final flourish of late 19th century Viennese intelligentsia, and there was a certain amount of pretension going around amongst the people who moved in the same circles as him.
I kind of feel like if he was about now, he'd only go to organic restaurants in
Oh, indeed.
Shoreditch.
He'd probably have a place in Soho that he could claim to live in, although he'd have a much more comfortable place that he didn't tell anyone about because he was also loaded.
And he would also tell you how far the food had travelled. Ah, this chicken has just come 4 miles.
Very concerned about his food miles. He's the sort of person who I suspect would eat mung bean curry on a regular basis.
Oh, just. I just think he was the worst.
Oh dear.
Right.
But compositionally fine.
But within our new format, I've set you a food challenge. So, what have you gone away and done?
So I've sort of mixed up both sides here. I looked at army rations, and basically, that was not very nice. So I got myself some corned beef, and the real challenge in that was actually opening the tin because it's square, and my tin opener didn't like it. But I hacked my way in eventually.
Because corned beef was mainly what the British soldiers was eating almost in its entirety, really.
Yeah. It's basically spam, but made from beef instead of ham. So it's edible.
Did you never have it at school?
No, because I went to school in Australia where they feed us
Oh.
properly.
Well, we used to have corned beef.
Yeah.
It was disgusting.
Yeah. So
I didn't tell you that beforehand.
yeah. You mentioned, I think. I hacked my way into the tin, but also because of the little quote you just did, you just read out, I had a go at making scrambled eggs with paprika in. I could only get dried paprika because, I don't know where to buy real paprika. Probably like a fancy store, Waitrosey sort of place, a bit upmarket. And I've got Tesco and Lidl near me, so those are my options. So I put in,
Supermarkets
yeah,
are
sorry,
a thing.
I put in a lot of the dried paprika, and the scrambled eggs did have a rather nice sort of smoky flavour to them, but I suspect it wasn't anywhere near the sort of strength of flavour that Berg would have had eating the fresh stuff. But it was enough to counteract the rather unappetizing portion of corned beef I lumped on the side of the plate. So, yeah, I ate it. I enjoyed the eggs and paprika. I took some photos of my food, which I've not been in the habit of doing previously. I'm not really a food photo sort of person.
Oh,
So, sort of.
we'll tweet your
Yes,
snack. We haven't.
I will tweet it, and Symphonies and Snacks, I'm sure, will tweet it as well. So, you can have a look at my meal in all its unappetizing glory.
If we were still doing composer puns, which I'm still doing anyway in my head,
You're a much better punner than me. You're a much better punner than me.
I am. I'd have had Alban burgers.
Oh, yeah. Although, interestingly, this is quite a pretentious moment, but Alban comes from Alba, which means white, and is often used in reference to white wine.
Yeah, that is pretentious.
Oh yeah, that's me. That's that Durham education for you.
I had the same one. Oh, but
Yeah,
I
you
went
went.
Hill.
Yeah, I went Bailey.
That means nothing to anyone listening.
Unless they went to Durham as well.
Yeah. So while you were doing that, I had a bit of a research into why Berg would be sneaking out, apart from the obvious rations. And I found out that Germany was in what they were calling the turnip winter.
Right.
So there was crop failure 1916 to 1917, and all that really survived was turnips. There were no potatoes and there was no cereal, just turnips. And it starts to sound like an episode of Blackadder.
Gonna say Baldrick would be in heaven.
Baldric was having the best time. Like, he was on the wrong side for all the turnips.
Yeah, so in Blackadder goes forth, he should have been on the other in the other trenches.
He'd have had so many turnips.
He'd have been
But they
swimming in
did
turnips.
everything turnips, including making bread. They used it instead of flour,
Yep.
and there were whole pamphlets of turnip recipes released all through the turnip winter to get through it.
It's a great name, the Turnip Winter.
The turnip winter. I mean, it sounds hilarious because of all the turnips, but it was horrific. It was like the potato famine.
Yeah. Except at least they still had something to eat.
Yes.
Even if it was just turnips.
Oh, it's really hard to take seriously.
They would have been very flatulent.
Yeah, oh, so many turnips. Yeah, that's all I have really.
So,
Here's turnip winter.
but he had the money to go and have paprika, egg, and fried vegetables, so.
I know, because he was the worst.
I'm sure he wasn't that bad. You know, he was taught by Arnold Schoenberg, who was
I sort of
probably
thought
a
you were going to
bigger
say
ego.
Schwarzenegger.
You thought I was going to say who?
Schwarzenegger.
No. Although from the same country. No, Schoenberg, who was one of the biggest egos ever to inflate his own head to the size of a prize pumpkin.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, you read anything by Schoenberg, it's basically, I'm the best person since Beethoven, and by the way, I'm better than Beethoven.
Do you know who's really like that?
No, I can think of a few people, but who were you going to say?
Berlioz.
Okay,
So
yeah.
I read Berlioz's memoirs in first year of my undergraduate, and it was all people just don't understand my genius. This is why I'm not winning prizes, because people don't understand what a genius I am.
Hang on, let me just find this
And he
quote.
spends an entire chapter of his memoirs planning to kill someone. And then he goes, "This isn't the best use of my resources."
Yeah, that sounds fairly pretentious.
He bought wigs so that he could dress up as an old woman.
Is that part of his murder plan to be dressed as an old woman?
Dress up as an old woman.
Yeah. No, just to take it back a little bit. This is a quote from Joseph Haydn. So not a contemporary composer by any means. But he once said, there was no one near me to confuse me, so I was forced to become original. Which I quite like. That tickles me.
Maybe we did this to each other. Maybe we confused each other at uni. That was our role.
And that's why we're not original?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
I'm so sorry. Right.
Shall we go back to talking about Fotseg?
Yeah.
Right. So there's a bit in the score that I really, really like, which was the mysterious music.
The mysterious music? Where are you talking about?
I can't remember where it is in the score, but it really reminded me of a Bill Bailey thing about the sound that plays when bad guys leave a room in 70s cop shows, which sounds like this.
It's vital to play it on the bass clarinet to obtain maximum effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that kept happening, which was also why I kept getting the giggles.
So you just kept hearing bad guys leaving the room.
Yes.
Throughout the opera.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's an insight.
I think I was in a different opera to you.
Yeah, I heard you laughing, and I could appreciate some comedy, but I was fairly convinced I was watching a tragedy, and quite a dark one at that. And you somehow went to see a dark comedy.
Yeah.
Right.
So the honky tonk.
Yeah, the honky tonk was pretty comedy.
So. All through the stage, a bit like Chekhov's gun, in the corner of the stage was an upright piano with no one at it.
And I actually pointed it out when we first went in and we could see the orchestra not on stage yet, but the big instruments obviously on stage, the harps, the percussion and so forth. And I was like, oh, an upright piano, that's unusual. Normally you'd have a grand piano if you were playing with an orchestra.
Yeah. So, nobody's at it. And next to it is a celesta.
A celesta, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Which is the sound from Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies.
It's basically a vibraphone, but instead of hitting it with hammer, it has a keyboard like a piano that triggers the hammers to hit it for you.
Mm.
Have some bad guys leaving the room.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's a celesta.
Yeah.
So there was a lady playing that, and this piano, not really.
Just sitting there.
Yeah, just.
And this is the joy of going to see a concert performance, because if you saw the staged opera, that would be hidden away in the orchestra pit and you probably wouldn't notice it.
Yeah. So when it starts playing, so like they go to this party scene and nobody's right, so they're all in front and this pianist comes on in his full tails and I'm like, this is it. Piano's gonna happen. And I was not expecting what did happen.
Yeah.
Have you got the clip?
I have indeed got the clip.
Tanz alle, tanz dazu! Schritt, schritt und stieg, es holt euch noch! Noch einmal der Teufel!
So that happened at that point.
I mean, it was pretty much this. basically. That's what happened.
Yeah.
In my head.
It took us somewhat by surprise, to say the least.
I'm gone.
Yeah. Another great moment, which is not really important to the opera, was our favourite percussionist at the back. The overprepared gong player.
There was a giant gong at the back. A
huge gong. One of the ones that you're really excited when you see the percussionist get ready to hit it.
Like, this is great.
He got ready. And we saw him. He had two beaters. He had a bunch of percussion instruments. He finished playing his... He had like a marimba... He had some tubular bells or something. I can't remember. Anyway, he put his old mallets down.
I didn't pay attention.
He picked up the big... Big mallets, you need to hit the gong, one in each hand. He shuffled his chair around so he was sitting with a leg and an arm either side of the gong, and he sat there, and he had the mallets ready, and he's ready to go, and he's sitting there, and we're waiting for a while. But, you know, he is a little bit of a quiet bit, so he obviously doesn't want to disturb that bit by moving around, so he's ready. And then we see him, and he lifts his hand, and we're like, here comes the gong, and he scratches his nose.
Then, it was the biggest letdown of my life.
And then we had to wait for quite a bit more, and then with his two mallets, ages later, he just hit the gong once quite gently, and that was it.
Yeah.
So that was quite towards the end. And I think we both clocked that without actually talking to each other.
I think you can feel the anticipation.
When you've got... And
everyone going...
Two massive mallets held either side of a gong for that long, the gong just needs to be struck.
So, I suppose another thing I want to address isn't directly about the opera, but about the audience.
Yeah.
So, we were sat in the bar beforehand, and they'd announced that it was the understudy who was going to go on.
Yeah, not even the understudy. So, it was the Zurich Orchestra who were touring this, and they had their singers with them. And when they come to London, I think it's Christian Gerhaer, is how you say his name. I'm not very good at that, pronouncing his name. And he came down ill the day before the performance, and we got the email sent out because we booked the tickets and said, we apologise that he's not going to be able to perform. And you're going to have Leo Melrose, who has sung this before with the English National Opera to great reviews. Yeah. Obviously, the English National Opera only sing in English, so we were slightly, you know...
That's where we get a bit snobby. Because originally we were going to see Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk.
Mtsensk.
But it was an English translation, and my view is it's been written in a language, it scans better in that language, sing it in the language. But I know that E&O present all their operas in English as an accessibility thing. So their view is that people are put off opera because they're having to read surtitles or they don't understand what's going on. I disagree. I think what happened next...
Yes. Sorry, go on.
I think what happened next in that bar is why people are put off opera, which was, I wasn't there for this.
No, you popped out and I was sitting next to where your seat was, and I shuffled across to make room. There were sofas, and I made a bit of room on the sofa because this other couple of guys, older guys, came in, obviously experienced opera observers of some time. Mm-hmm. And they came in and they sat next to me, and they're starting to talk, and they're... Oh, I'm very disappointed that Christian isn't here. I only really came to hear him sing. I mean, who in their right mind would sit through a concert performer to Wozzeck? Which annoyed me a little bit, because that's exactly what I was there to do, to sit through a concert performance of Wozzeck, and I'd like to think I'm in my right mind.
But I think there is so much kind of withholding of knowledge from opera. Like, it's this thing of we know who the good singers are, and we understand this and for everyone, and you dress a certain way and you act a certain way and you applaud for so long.
Applause goes on for ages. They're not going to do an encore. They've done an hour and a half of opera with no interval, you know? They're not going to do you anything else for you. Applaud politely. What's... and then move on.
I just don't get why people make it this private members thing.
Mm.
Of, you know, we understand this and other people don't. And I always felt like that when we studied opera at uni, because I didn't really do any before we got there.
And you can hear the way I'm talking here. I don't, you know, I'm not someone who follows opera intensely, so I'm not 100% sure about my pronunciation of either of the names of the singers, to be honest. Mm. But obviously these people I was sat next to, they're very au fait with who the good singers are, and they were rather snobbish about the fact that the one they wanted to see was being replaced.
Yeah. It brings out the worst in me, though, and I want to say really ridiculous things to people. So I want to go, oh, actually, I feel his performance may be better. The original, he really doesn't have the gravitas.
One thing, actually, that I quite liked was the fact that the guy who was singing it had got called up effectively the morning of the performance.
Yeah.
He'd sung it in German, in English before, but not for a while. I think the ENO last did it in 2012 or something like that. So it's a few years ago since he sang it. He knows the part, but he's not got it off by heart, and he's certainly not got the German off by heart. So he's singing from a score, so he stood there. And actually, I thought it really enhanced the character of Wozzeck for me, because he felt so closed off, and that's how this character felt to me as well. He's just sort of accepting what's going on in his life, and everyone else is doing all the action around him and pushing him around, and almost having this guy this just sort of staring down at his book to get the words a lot of the time, he felt very introspective and introverted. And I think it, without him having to act, it enhanced the characterization for me.
Yeah. And so, we wanted to go to a concert performance of Wozzeck, so...
We're in our right minds. At least one of us is. Lucy, if not me.
Huh. Normally goes the other way. I'm pleased with that. Do we have any other elements we want to talk about? I mean, I've done 70s bad guy. I've done honky tonk, Mickey Mousing. I've really classed this up.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think is our aim with opera, to keep it as high class as possible, obviously.
Yeah.
Just
keep it classy.
Yeah. No. I think we've covered the important stuff. I would say if you get the chance to see this or listen to a recording of it or anything, really go for it. It's a big piece. It takes about an hour and a half, like I said, but it is really worthwhile, I think. If you get a version where you can follow the plot, if you know German, if you have to hear it in English, or if you get to see it live with surtitles, whatever, the plot is quite interesting. If you know Wojciech, the play it's based on, you might get some of it.
The orchestration made it worth it.
Mm.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So.
And also, I would like somebody else's opinion on whether this was a comedy.
I believe that I have the backing of Bird. Not Bird, Berg. But also Bird, if he was alive. If either of them were alive. But this is a tragedy. And certainly, I think Georg Büchner, who wrote Wojciech, intended it as a tragedy. So, I feel like I have the sort of moral high ground in this argument, Lucy.
Oh, but well...
hopefully, you know, some of the listeners will incline to your point of view, and we can have a genuine discussion on this thing.
Yeah. Can I recommend another favourite opera?
Because
I know I said I wasn't very pro-opera, but there's one by Shostakovich, which is called The Nose.
Mm.
Maybe we'll do it in the future. But it's about a man who loses his nose, and then when he finds it, his nose is higher in society than he is and won't come back to him.
Yes, and that is sort of a comedy and also rather cutting
social commentary.
This is very
serious.
Yeah.
Yep. We don't joke about noses.
No. Well, yeah, given the political climate Shostakovich was writing in.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll maybe come back to one sometime.
Yeah. That's my favourite.
So you can follow the show on at Symphony Snack on Twitter. We haven't tweeted for a while. We'll get back on that. We're going to tweet Jono's food. You can follow me at LA Harrison Music. The other day I was tweeting some more composer puns. I was doing insect composers. Do you want to hear my insects?
I am at Aussie Jono. I'm not the most regular of Twitter, but I will tweet stuff related to the show, including...
You didn't want to hear my insects.
Oh, I thought people were going to go and read them.
No.
Oh, let's have some insect composers.
Beethoven ant.
Yes.
And bee say.
Indeed. Well...
Anyway,
if you'd like to suggest more of those, tweet them to Lucy and not to me. Sorry, that sounds like I'm a complete horrible person with no sense of humour. I'd love to hear them.
I would really appreciate them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please try to theme them if you can.
Yeah. Should we say what the next show is?
Yeah, certainly. So we're going to be fortnightly with this new format, aren't we?
Yes. Unless, you know, something really important comes up.
Yeah. If there's a special episode that he's doing, we'll get it out on time. But roughly fortnightly. Well, no, not roughly. Fortnightly.
Hmm.
Indeed.
But our next one will be a special.
Yep.
We will be doing a James Bond special, looking at some of the theme songs, some of the scores. Please tweet us any snack suggestions and we'll get on that. Otherwise, it's just vodka martinis.
Which are not my favourite drink by any means.
Yeah. So which part of Wozzeck or Wozzeck shall we play out with?
That's a good question.
Orchestral postlude?
Yeah, so let's play it out with the orchestral postlude to Wozzeck. It seems appropriate way to finish this show.